It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, between figuring out what's for dinner and where your kid should go to school, parenting presents an endless amount of decisions. We talked to an economist about why she advocates for approaching these choices with a business mindset. Now, according to the Associated Press, the number of highway deaths in 2020 was the greatest in more than a decade, despite the fact that fewer miles were actually driven during the pandemic. According to the data, the higher death toll is related to higher than average driving speeds, along with more cases of people driving on roads under the influence of drugs or alcohol, and a slight decline in seatbelt use. And we want to hear from you and what you think at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed a change in the way people are driving in your area since the pandemic began? Does it seem as though there is more speeding or racing on the roads? What have you seen in your communities? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Evelyn Vangelis is a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Epidemiology and Biostatistics and the director of the Population and Community Health Unit at Western University in Ontario, Canada. She's authored numerous papers looking at the behavioral and environmental risk factors when it comes to driving. Evelyn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So take us back to the last year. There was a belief that we would probably see fewer deaths on the roadways during the pandemic. We didn't see that. We've talked a little bit about it, but were you surprised about the statistics that you saw?
Yes, I was. On the other hand, I wasn't, because of what I was hearing just down the street from me. As we were moving into the pandemic, I certainly began to hear racing going nonstop. You could almost set your clock on it for Friday and Saturday nights at 10 o'clock. So it was rather intriguing, because if you look at the research, whenever you have an economic downturn, what you tend to see is a decrease in motor vehicle fatalities, in particular among younger people, because they're more likely to lose their jobs and therefore less likely to have the finances to engage in, well, first of all, to be driving to work and back, and number two, to have the finances to engage in entertainment types of activities, which can get them into trouble. So it was rather surprising when we began to figure out from what police were finding that there were increases in speeding-related tickets, dramatic increases in speeding-related tickets, in stunt driving, in aggressive driving, and so on. And then certainly in some jurisdictions and in some countries, as in the United States, you did see an increase in motor vehicle fatalities.
Now, I want to go back to something you just mentioned, which was an increase in stunt driving. I'm guessing racing falls into that. You know, what could be at play with the rise of that kind of risky driving on the roadways?
Well, this is still fairly new in the pandemic, so we don't have the hard research in terms of having completed research on the topic. In fact, as we speak, I've got three projects that I'm going to be investigating it. So I can only be surmising from other research that we have done on stunt driving. I mean, one of the things that we know is as the pandemic came down, we had lockdowns, a lot of people lost their jobs. Particularly younger individuals were more susceptible to job loss, you know, schools locked down and so on. So we had certainly surveys have shown that a lot of individuals experienced increases in stress, increases in boredom, loss of their usual routine. And one of the places where you could socially distance would be driving in your car. So you can't go to bars, you can't go to parties, you can't engage in other kinds of activities you're normally used to doing, perhaps getting together with your buddies in your vehicles. could be a way to do it. And so then you began to see these different meets that occurred. We had a meet in Ontario where through social media, over 1,000 young people gathered. And part of their, when you have a group of young males together, you know, part of the purpose is to show off. So you have them showing off their driving, you know, doing their donuts, their burnouts, all of the different types of drag racing, street racing, et cetera. And then, of course, with social media on top of it, they then upload various videos of them showing off their driving. As this continued, I'm thinking, and this is what I think we'll be finding, is that this type of norm, this behavior then became normative. You always had a cohort of young men that were engaged in these types of activities. Typically, they are your sensation seekers and so on. They're involved in other kinds of delinquent activities. But I'm thinking that a larger cohort of young people got involved during the pandemic because, as I said, you've got boredom, working, maybe school is out, and so on. So what you're seeing on the roadways may well be these types of activities. In Ontario, what we did find is before COVID, we were already seeing an increase in aggressive driving. And it seemed that COVID just simply exacerbated this even more. Whether this is occurring in other jurisdictions, such as Wisconsin, et cetera, we don't have the data for it, but it may well be something similar going on.
We are talking to Evelyn Vangelis right now, professor in the Departments of Family Medicine and Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the Western University in Ontario, Canada. And I would like to go to one of our callers right now. We have Terry in Milwaukee. Hi, Terry.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. What did you want to talk about, Terry?
Well, mentioned to the person who answered the phone, I live in Milwaukee, and on an average, I will see 3 cars a day without any license plate driving extremely recklessly for many reasons, because they don't know how to drive or whatever, they're too young or something. And driving completely has changed in that you need to be so, so much more defensive. I was saying how the lines that are on the freeway, those are not decorations. Those are lines that are designed to not cross over. And I have seen numerous people crossing over 3 lanes and then again crossing over all that grid mark on the highway to get off at an exit. It's just sad. It's very sad.
Terry, thank you so much for that call. Terry talking about reckless driving on highways in particular. We've been talking about stunt driving, but outside of that cohort of younger men that you pointed to, have we seen an increase of just reckless driving across the board?
Well, one of the things that you do see with aggressive driving is twofold. One is the initially inadvertent aggressive driving. And by that, I mean is as the roads emptied out, individuals inadvertently were going faster because you don't have cars to slow you down around you. And as your foot became a little more heavy as you were driving, again, over time, that behavior became normative. So it wasn't that you purposely had a penchant for driving at very high speeds, but that was sort of kind of a normative behavior that, again, has occurred. And it's called speed adaptation. I'm sure you know, as you drive off an exit of a highway, that you might be driving onto a road that says 35 miles an hour, but you look down your speedometer, you realize, oh my gosh, I'm going 50 miles an hour because you've adapted to that higher speed. So that's sort of one group of individuals. And then, as I said, you've also got another group of individuals that have been bored, that have been stressed out. They already have a penchant for higher sensation seeking, more for engaging in delinquent activities, and they can engage in a whole range of aggressive, high-risk behaviors, quite often without ever thinking through the consequences of these behaviors. And that's also sort of an adolescent developmental aspect that, unfortunately, It's not until the mid-20s to late 20s do the majority of young people really have their brain fully developed, in which they're able to think through the consequences for their actions. So younger people generally are higher risk-taking than older people. It's a neurodevelopmental phase in their life. So yes, one does see, as I say, more aggressive driving in older other drivers inadvertently, although again, some of them can be speed demons too, no question. And then you have got younger drivers that generally tend to be more risk-taking as drivers.
We're talking to Evelyn Vangelis right now, a professor in the departments of family medicine, epidemiology, and biostatistics, and the director of the Population and Community Health Unit at Western University in Ontario, Canada. She researches behavioral and environmental risk factors when it comes to driving, and we want to hear from you. Have you experienced faster driving on the roadways as you've been going to and from your home? Maybe you have noticed that you've been driving a little bit faster than normal, and you know, what is your takeaway from being on the roads? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org, and we'll continue this conversation in just a moment right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now we're picking up the conversation with researcher on behavior and environmental risk factors, as you know, as it pertains to aggressive driving. Evelyn Vangelis is a professor in the departments of family medicine, epidemiology, and biostatistics, and the director of the Population and Community Health Unit at Western University in Ontario, Canada. And we are taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed more changes in the way people are driving in your area? Have you seen more speeding, more accidents? And how have the roadways felt to you? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Evelyn, one thing that struck me in our conversation so far is this very risky driving, certainly during the pandemic. And I remember early on in the pandemic, there were these sort of sensational news stories about people attempting the Cannonball Run, which is that race where you can see how fast you can get from New York to Los Angeles. And people were breaking records that because there were so much fewer people on the road. Did you see a sort of sensationalized kind of narrative happening around this that maybe played a factor in more people driving recklessly?
Well, I think that could well be the case for individuals that are interested and prone and interested in vehicles. Certainly social media has been a avenue by which to encourage individuals to engage in risky driving behavior. My research associate and I engaged in doing actually a content analysis of YouTube videos where we were looking at risky driving, in particular stunt driving, street racing, etc. And what was very interesting in the overwhelming majority of these videos was that nowhere was there any indication that what was engaged in was risky. It was always presented in a very sort of fun and challenging manner. And I've also done focus groups with young males and asked them whether they thought that these types of videos could affect their driving and the driving of other people. And what the gentleman said in the focus groups was some of them said, no, it wouldn't, you know, it's not my thing. I wouldn't engage in it at all. But particularly young individuals in their teens, perhaps they might be much more susceptible to this kind of driving. And there are still within the different groups of focus groups, some individuals say, yeah, I think I'm going to pull my motorcycle out and start doing some stunts and wheelies, etc. I'm not going to do it on the roadways. I'll go to a track. But you could see that even just watching little clippets in our focus groups was enough to trigger for some individuals an interest. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go out now and engage in these kinds of behaviors. But they did qualify it for our group, not as risky, but still they're going to do it. So indeed, I think that these kinds of sensational types of driving behaviors can entice and can encourage and can influence certain individuals to engage in the activities. And then with social media, you've got the added element that they can then upload themselves doing it and then get the accolades for that too. So it's kind of a double circular type of behavioral mechanism in which it can influence behavior and then further reinforce the behavior by uploading their own activities on it.
Evelyn, I want to go back to our calls right now. We have Roderick in Milwaukee. Hi, Roderick.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what did you want to bring up, Roderick?
Well, just in terms of driving, I drive approximately 8,000 miles a week going across the entire country delivering furniture and artwork. So I have a pickup and a 24-foot trailer, but in terms of aggressiveness and just the way that people drive throughout the country in different sections is amazing. Talking about the social media, I probably see 70 to 80% of drivers on the phone, videoing, you name it, while they're driving. The most part, as soon as you get into or near cities, larger cities, is when the speeds tend to pick up going in or going out. And I don't understand it. The psychology, they've got to get around, they've got to get there, and they have no idea what's going on, and they just continue to drive, and they see traffic, they see people who are on the side of the road. They just keep going because they're on the phone or whatever.
Roderick, thank you so much for that call. And, you know, one thing that Roderick mentioned is that he drives a lot. He makes deliveries. And there are people whose livelihood, you know, is really tied to being on the road. You know, how are people like long-haul drivers impacted by this kind of aggressive driving?
Well, in fact, one of my a recent students who is a family physician here was actually examining long-haul truck drivers and did in-depth interviews with them. And indeed, those that are professional drivers very much speak to the incredible aggressive driving, incredible high-risk driving that is engaged in, just as your previous caller mentioned, on the roadways. And it makes them very nervous because, as you said, it's their livelihood, but they also know that they are driving a tractor trailer that does not have the capacity to stop on a dime. To maneuver around vehicles. So when you've got individuals that are doing high-risk driving around them, it makes them doubly nervous as drivers themselves. And I think one of the problems is that a lot of people, particularly those that aren't professional drivers, have delusions about how easy driving is. And for the most part, right, if you're driving and if you're driving just on a highway, there are not too many cars around, you don't really need to be cognitively processing everything. So people get into a laissez-faire view of driving. And if you look at all of the survey research, we have no poor drivers. If we ask people to rank their driving in terms of exceptional, excellent, very good, average, poor, nobody considers themselves to be a poor driver. So we've also got the element of delusion that people think that, oh, I'm a exceptional driver. I can't do anything wrong until something happens. And then it's always the other guy's fault. A third element that has been occurring, particularly during COVID, is the sense with a lot of drivers is there aren't as many police officers around patrolling the roadways. And police officers on the roadways, tickets, et cetera, that's a deterrent. If people think that the chances of getting caught are high, if they think that the penalty is high, and they think that it's quite certain that they will, and swift, they'll get a penalty, a fine, then they are more likely to stop their behavior, to be deterred from the risky driving that they're doing. But a lot of individuals have thought, well, police aren't going to stop and pick me over because of COVID. And oh, probably a number of them are not well anyway, so they're not as many around. So that has been sort of a double whammy in terms of people thinking they have the license to drive more risky because nobody's around to stop them.
Evelyn, I want to go back to our callers right now. We have Carrie in La Crosse. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I'm from La Crosse. Well, I'm from Milwaukee, and I live in La Crosse, and I drive between the two cities. And I'm what you would call an aggressive driver, or in your case, a risky driver. But sometimes I feel like as I'm driving on the freeway or in the city, like even the small town, that it's the more non-risky drivers or the safe drivers that are actually causing more accidents because they're going under the speed limit or right at the speed limit when the rest of the traffic isn't, and they're not paying as much attention to everything around them, where the aggressive drivers tend to be watching all the lanes of what's happening, looking at using all their mirrors, and they know what's going on, so they can be more aggressive, where the non-aggressive drivers are the ones that are sometimes causing the accidents because they're not keeping speed with traffic or paying as much attention.
Carrie, thank you so much for that call. Evelyn, is there a risk to maybe being a little too cautious on the road?
Well, there's two elements that are being discussed here. Number one, what's called speed differential. Yes, you can have higher rates of collisions where you have got differential speeds on roadways. So if you've got one person going 50, another person going 90, then that is more likely to cause higher opportunities for motor vehicle collisions. The second element is about aggressive driving. I have studied hundreds of aggressive drivers, and to presume that, again, that it's the drivers that drive the speed limit or drive sensibly are less likely to be involved in collisions, that's not true. My own research has shown that individuals that report aggressive, risky driving behaviors consistently have much higher collision rates and much higher offense rates, significantly, statistically significantly higher collision and offense rates than average drivers.
Well, Evelyn, we're gonna have to leave it there since we're running out of time. But thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Evelyn Vinkilis is a professor in the departments of family medicine and epidemiology and biostatistics, and the director of the Population and Community Health Unit at Western University in Ontario, Canada. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to an economist about better ways to work through decisions big and small in your family. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up on the Ideas Network, Milwaukee Bucks MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo is a superstar that helped lead the Bucks to an NBA championship this year. But his ascent to stardom was far from a sure thing. On the morning show, they talked to Miran Fader, author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP, tomorrow after 8. Now, parenting presents you with a million choices, from decisions like how much screen time your kid should get, where they should go to school, or even what kind of parent you want to be. For many families, making their way through all of these decisions day to day can be chaotic and exhausting. But our guest says that there may be a better way if we approach those family decisions with a business mindset, especially as those kids grow between the ages of 5 and 12. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are some of the big decisions you've struggled with as a parent? Maybe it's limiting screen time or deciding when to get your kid a cell phone. How did you go about picking where your kids go to school? Or did you only have one option? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Emily Oster is an economics professor at Brown University. She's also the author of multiple books, including her latest, The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've written a number of books about parenting, typically a little bit on the younger side, younger kids. Why did you want to write The Family Firm?
So my kids got a bit older, and I found that the data-oriented approach I was taking with younger kids was still helpful, but needed a little bit more scaffolding, that we were spending a lot of time thinking about logistics and trying to make decisions that were sometimes unexpected. And so this book is really an attempt to help families sort of think about, in that world of a lot of decisions and a lot of logistics, how can you craft a life that is going to make you happy, and how can you make some of those decisions deliberately, intentionally, thoughtfully.
And how does a business mindset factor in here?
I think the real insight, the real business parallel here, is the idea that when businesses, when firms make decisions, they have processes to do that, and they think about how any individual decision fits in the big picture of the firm. And I think that's, in many ways, the central lesson of the book, is that each individual decision we make should be part of a larger set, of a sort of larger vision of how we want our lives to look, rather than what I think we sometimes do in our households, which is make every little tiny decision on its own without thinking about how it will influence the whole shape of our day and of our years.
Well, let's look at that big picture, because you say that parents should engage with that and that families should engage with that. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that process will look like at the family level?
Yeah, so I think the big key is to have families think about, you know, at the end of the day, what do you want your day to look like? Do you want to be having dinner together as a family? Do you want your kids to be going to bed early? Do you want to be out doing a bunch of extracurriculars? Is it important to you that your kids play an intense competitive sport? Really thinking about which style of life do you want to have? Like, really, what do you want Tuesday to look like? What would be your ideal? And then, you know, being a little realistic about the constraints that we face. But I think that often we don't step back and really almost write down, what do we want our schedules to look like? And by doing that, we can then think, you know, hey, if I want to eat dinner every night at 6, maybe I can't do all these different extracurriculars. Maybe I actually need to do less in order to deliver a priority that may be more important to me.
Now, you were talking just a little bit about the sort of scaffolding that some of these decisions need, and you actually outline what you call the 4 F's. Can you talk step by step about what those are and how they work in this process?
Sure. So the idea here is to have a framework, a system for making kind of big decisions, things like what school should my kid go to? And the first F is to frame the question, to actually think about the specific choices you have, not just a sort of general what school, but actually let me define a couple of options. The second step is to fact find, to sit down and think about what does the data say about what makes a good school and which of these schools would better serve my kid, but also how would this fit into other aspects of our life? How would we manage logistics? Is this financially feasible? How would we make it work? You do that work. And then there's a third step, which is I call final decision, where I urge people to basically decide on a time to decide, rather than letting the decision percolate and percolate and percolate and change all the time, to really say, get your data, make your decision, and then try to move on. Except there's a fourth F, which is follow up, which is the idea that we really, as in many of these, even these big decisions, they aren't permanent, they aren't forever. If you send your kid to one school, you can think about reevaluating that if there's another option, and that we should plan to do that reevaluation. We should accept the possibility that some of these decisions, even if we make them very thoughtfully, they could turn out to be wrong in the end, and we should be willing to change our mind. And that if we have an explicit plan for follow-up, then we will be more likely to make better choices and use the information we've learned from what has come before. So that's the 4 steps.
We are talking to Emily Oster right now, author of multiple books and an economist. Her latest book is The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early Years. And you're a parent. You've got 2 kids. Can you talk about how you have utilized this so far in your own life?
So I think there's kind of two pieces. One is that, you know, in our family, there are some things that are very central to us. So family dinner being kind of a big one. And that's important to us, not, I should be clear, not because of some secret thing in the data that if you don't have a family dinner, your kids will turn out terrible, but really just that it's very important to my husband and I. It's something that we enjoy, that we like to do. And so that's an aspect that we've prioritized and that we partly prioritized by sort of sitting down and thinking about, okay, this is actually something that we want to do. We want to put ahead of almost anything else. And that influences our many other things. It influences what kind of extracurriculars we can do. It influences, you know, other choices that we make about how much we work and when we work and so on. So that's an example where I think being clear on what is important to us in that case, not so much because of data, but just because of our preferences, has really changed or influenced how we run our days.
And you have included your daughter in part of this decision making. You know, some parents might say, hey, I'm in charge. I get to make all the decisions. But what do you think it says to have your kids have a say?
I think that having our kids have a say, at least for us, is very important because then they will be more bought into they will understand where we're coming from and they will be more bought into the choices that we make. And we don't, I want to be clear, like we try to incorporate the kids after we have decided what the feasible options are. So we're just having an exchange today about, you know, what kinds of things would we do in the fall after school and, you know, getting to a point where we had agreed, okay, we are comfortable with either this choice or this other choice. And so now we're going to bring it to our daughter and say, okay, like, let's talk about, you know, what's going to work, but within some scaffolding. So if she said, you know, I want to do my homework at midnight, that's just not an option because she needs to be asleep. And so there's a kind of limit to the choice, but I think giving kids that autonomy then prepares them for being adults, which for me is kind of a big part of how I think about approaching my parenting is I'm trying to raise an adult, somebody who eventually, as sad as it makes me, will sort of leave me and be on their doing things on their own.
Right now, we are talking to Emily Oster. She's an economics professor at Brown University, and she's with us to talk about her latest book, The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. And this looks at how a business mindset and that sort of scaffolding that you might see in an office space might be able to be applied for some better, easier family decision-making. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you make decisions in your own family? Is it reactive and maybe a little chaotic? Or have you found a system that really does work well with you? And does what you're hearing from Emily really resonate? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we'll continue this conversation and maybe hear from you in just a moment right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Thanks for being with us. Right now, we are picking up our talk with economist and author Emily Oster about her latest book, The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you have any questions about Emily's methods or how she's approaching it, we want to hear from you. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Emily, before the break, we were talking about how you have utilized this in your own family. And I want to look at just some examples because you have a lot of data about how some of these examples might shake out. And so let's talk about screen time, because that's a big thing that parents are concerned about. You hear study after study saying, hey, don't let your kids look at too much screens. So how do you approach screen time for 5 to 12 year olds with your system?
So I think that the key thing in the data on screen time is to separate out two pieces. One is the information we have about the influence of content. And when you look at the how much it matters what kids are watching, some of the more sort of hysterical concerns, like if your kid watches violent stuff, they'll become violent, that doesn't seem to be very supported in the data. So that doesn't mean there isn't a role for kind of curating what your kids watch. Of course there is. But that the content piece, there isn't something that says, you know, you have to watch a particular kind of content. The other piece, probably more important in some ways, is to think about the fact that when your kid is watching TV, they're not doing something else. And so there's a displacement aspect of TV that if your kid is watching TV for 6 hours a day, they're not, you know, doing their homework or going outside or doing some other things. And that those other things could deliver outcomes that you care more about, or that could be better for your kid in some way. And so I think there's a little bit of a kind of thinking carefully about how does this fit in? How does this time fit in your day? But that doesn't mean that there's no screens in this. And the way I sometimes put it to people is, if your kid told you every night before dinner, I'm going to go upstairs and I'm going to stare at my wall for an hour, and I'm just going to be quiet, and I'm going to let you cook dinner, I'm just going to stare at the wall, you would be like, wow, my kid's such a great meditator. You know, they love meditating. That's so good for them. And in some sense, but it would still be displacing. You know, they still wouldn't be practicing the violin or doing their homework, but you wouldn't have the same feeling. And I think that there's a sense in which you kind of want to think about, sometimes we all need a downtime. Sometimes we need a break, and that the alternative may just be getting crankier and hungrier and people yelling. And instead, actually, some screen time is probably better. So I think there's, you know, like with everything, there's kind of a balance and really a value to thinking about where is this going to fit in the structure of the day, such that it can deliver some of those, you know, benefits, because screen time is nice, without displacing other things that you think are important.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of sort of balance that needs to be had when you are taking a lot of this into consideration, because, you know, I'll admit this, I am not a parent, but I read a lot about parenting as part of my job, and because it's interesting. And, you know, there's a lot of conflicting information out there about what you should and you should not do. And so one of the things I'm curious about is, how does your framework, I guess, kind of fit into the overall, hey, parenting is tough, here's an idea?
I mean, I think it's one idea. You know, I think that in the book, I try to sort of push in the direction of having some things that are actionable, both in the sense of having data that is actionable. So, you know, not all of the data is perfect, but there are pieces like, what do we know about sleep, or what do we know about, you know, how kids learn to read, things where you actually, there is some concrete action, some choice that you might make differently if you knew this. And then I think the second piece is, again, to sort of try to be very practical, even about some of these kind of abstract, big picture planning things. So, you know, rather than saying something like, you know, think about all your, like, you know, how you want your life to look in an abstract way. I say that, but then, you know, there's a piece of this that says, actually, you kind of should write down like what should happen in the different hours. So I think there's a practicality that comes from the fact that I am an economist, and therefore drawn to the practical.
We're talking to Emily Oster right now. As she said, she is an economist. She's also an author. Her latest book is The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. Now, you've also written a lot about the different kinds of parenting styles. Parents obviously want the best outcome for their kids, but how they execute it might be very different. Of course, we've heard about, you know, authors and scholars like Amy Chua, when she is a self-described tiger mom, so a little bit more strict. Then you have the helicopter parent, and then you also have, on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have free range parents. Can you just talk about, you know, the different range of styles and how that also fits in?
So there are, of course, many labels that we put on parents. I don't like the idea of labels, because I feel like somehow it makes us have to choose. And that, in fact, you know, you could be a person who, you know, cares tremendously about like doing extra tutoring, and also a person who has some more kind of free range kind of things where you want to give people more, you want to give your kids more, you know, physical autonomy, physical freedom. So I don't think that we should have to choose this. I think there is in the data, again, a sort of like a little bit of an up the middle compromise when we think about independence. So on the one hand, some scaffolding and involvement in, say, kids' educational experiences seems to deliver better outcomes for kids, seems to have them, you know, perform better in school, do better in general, less likely to have sort of bad things happen. But on the other hand, it also seems clear that there it is possible to be too involved, and that kids, particularly in college, when they sort of perceive their parents to be too involved, that can lead to anxiety, depression, and a sort of general sense of unhappiness, at least in the data. So I think there's sort of some happy medium here, which is part of why the idea of like, I'm going to be this kind of parent I don't think we need to make people choose. I think you could do worksheets and still let your kid walk home alone.
And it also sounds like you can adapt over time. You can evolve, as you have said, as part of your own scaffolding. Not all these decisions are permanent. You can always keep learning. Can you, I want to get back to some of the data, because I know that there are parents out there that are really grappling with this. So in two parent households in particular, many of them weigh the pros and cons of both parents working or perhaps one parent staying at home. Can you talk about the data that you found and how people might be able to, you know, apply that to their own situations?
Yeah. So I think often the question people ask is, you know, well, what's going to happen? Like, what's good for my kid? And, you know, I think it should first be clear that that's only a part of this, that, you know, there are other reasons why parents would choose to work or not to work. Maybe they like it. There are financial reasons that people make these choices. So, you know, thinking about what is going to deliver some particular outcome for my kid is only a really small part of this. When we look at something like test scores, there are, you know, some studies that'll show you that, you know, working is good for kids' test scores. Some studies will show you working is not good for kids' test scores. Maybe it varies what kind of family it is, but all of those effects are tiny. So like if they're positive, they're tiny, they're negative, they're tiny, they're on average about zero. There just isn't much in the data that would say that this matters for how your kid performs in school. There's actually a little bit more evidence that maybe kids who have two working parents are slightly more likely to be overweight. Although again, those effects are fairly small. And they seem to have a lot to do with what your kid is doing after school. So thinking, you know, carefully a little bit about making sure that your kid is, you know, active, even if you are both working is part of that. But on the whole, I would say this lets people off the hook a little bit in the sense that it says, really, this decision should be something about what works for the family, not something about one of these things being the right way to parent or the better way to parent.
You know, as you delved into this book, was there any data out there that actually surprised you?
There's a lot of data on the best way for kids to learn to read, and I hadn't thought that much about it, but there's just very, very strong evidence in the direction that we should be teaching kids with a phonics-based approach, that phonics is just like really, really important in learning to read. And that isn't how it's always done, but it makes a tremendous amount of sense when you dig into it. And I think I found that both surprising and also, you know, quite actionable as a person who was at the time I was doing this trying to teach one of my children to read.
And Emily, as we start to wrap up, you know, what is one thing that you really hope that parents take away from your book?
I think, you know, in a sense, when you write a book that's like, this is like run your family like a business, I think people's first thought is like, oh, this is a book about using spreadsheets to make my kids do more soccer. And like, I don't need another book about spreadsheets to make my kids do more soccer. But I actually think what I would like people to take away is almost the opposite. That basically using intentionality, doing this deliberately, is actually a way to do less, if that's what you want, is a way to sort of think about what are the things that are important? And particularly as we kind of move, I don't know, out of the pandemic, I don't exactly know how to put it at this point, but as people sort of recover from last year and return, particularly with kids, to kind of more of a normal school schedule and so on, and there's an opportunity to think about, of all the things we were doing before, if there were many of them, which of them do we want to introduce and to reintroduce? And are there things that we were doing that we now actually don't want to do anymore? And that there's a moment for being thoughtful about those choices.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Emily Oster. She's an economist and the author of multiple books about parenting. And she was with us today to talk about her latest book, The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early Years. You are listening right now to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Sports memorabilia fans were in for a treat, or maybe a shock, this Sunday when an extremely rare baseball card sold for a lot of money. A T206 Hannes Wagner baseball card set a record when it sold for $6.6 million, making it the most expensive baseball card ever sold. That unseated a Mickey Mantle rookie card that sold for more than $5 million earlier this year. The card features shortstop Hannes Wagner, also known as the Flying Dutchman. Wagner's baseball career spanned from 1897 through 1917, and he spent much of his time with the Pittsburgh Pirates. He's widely considered one of the greatest baseball players ever. According to ESPN, there are only 60 known cards known to exist, compared to, say, more than 4,000 Ty Cobb cards from that series that are still around. Now, no one really knows why there are so few of the cards today. One theory says the printing plate broke during production. Another, that Hannes Wagner had a dispute with the tobacco company that was printing the cards. Really, it's a mystery, and it's a very pricey mystery. A little bit of sports, a little bit of business, and a little bit of history right here on Central Time.